Yehudim, Shalom Bnei Noach, Shalom Goyim. It's the evening of the sixth day, Kaf Beis, B'Menachem Av, Parashas Ekev, Tavshin Ayin Vav, the evening of the fifth day, Thursday, 25 August 2016, webcasting from the hills of Judea, origin of the word Jew, which surely contributes to the hostility toward the so-called settlers who live in the settlements in Judea and Samaria, a.k.a. the West Bank. As I take note of my book, one night in March 1938, after midnight, a convoy of trucks and buses transporting a group of young Palestinian Zionist pioneers and their equipment, among them these atheistic socialistic chalutzim, Moshe Dayan and Yigal Alon, reached to the north and at their destination along the uninhabited border with Lebanon in the dead of night and threw up a fence for defense, a watchtower, a dining room and tents to sleep in, and they were the heroes of the day. In the Yeshuv, the Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael at the time, as it was called, for their pioneering, brave effort, setting up a settlement there was considered going into the lion's jaw because there were so many Arabs in the vicinity. But when religious Jews build settlements in Judean Samaria, well, that's another story. For Dayan and Alon and their community, the one that produced Rabin and Peres, etc., building communities for Jews for religious reasons is a no-no. These were atheists, these were socialists. And so horrifying was the sudden possession in 1967 of Judea and Samaria for its religious associations. The Sabra elite here just would not even use the names Judea and Samaria. They were called the Shtachim HaKvushim, the conquered areas. And even to this day, the West Bank, which my book shows came into use in 1968, was used to describe the territory that Jordan had overrun in 1948. And the next year, the West Bank, I aver, is evidence of the lie of a Palestinian people, because normally peoples bestow names on natural features like mountains, rivers, lakes, and streams. Historically, the Arabs never had a name for the hills of Judea and Samaria. West Bank was the name invented after the illegal Jordanian conquest. It was the West Bank of the state of Jordan, but that's still no name, just a topographical description. And that is the name the Sabras preferred and still use for Judea and Samaria. The West Bank that covers up the name on maps for thousands of years, a name identifying the land with the Jews. So here is the lead in the J-Post story today about that Brussels Airlines decision never to carry produce from Judea and Samaria. It seems an anti-Jew passenger flying out of Tel Aviv complained that he was served halva made by Jews in Judea and Samaria. Only, of course, that was not the name he used. And not the name J-Post used. Listen to this, quote, Brussels Airlines has taken halva off its menu after a disgruntled passenger alerted its staff that the vanilla-flavored snack was made in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. Belgian media cited a pro-Palestinian group as saying that the national airline had not been aware of the nature of the product and the violent and illegal institutions behind it, close quote. Yeah, well, on one level, this is an outbreak of more BDS fever. But that's not my concern here. I'm not concerned with the behavior of this disgruntled anti-Jew air passenger or the Belgian airline. It's the Jerusalem Post that concerns me. The Jerusalem Post that uses the terms Israeli settlement and West Bank. What the Judaized Israeli like these don't get is the connection between their own work, particularly in the Jerusalem Post, which is read by the world that is interested in what's going on here, and the hostility to Israel in the world. By referring to Judea and Samaria as the West Bank, the Jerusalem Post and all Jews who use this lexicon contribute to anti-Semitism by affirming the proposition that Jews do not belong in Judea and Samaria. They are settlers, as opposed to the enlightened denizens of Ramat Aviv, site of Tel Aviv University, built on what used to be a crummy Arab settlement called Sheikh Munis, their idea of a village, when none of these Arab communities, now called villages, deserve that name. Morally, legally, the so-called settlements in Judea and Samaria are no different than Tel Aviv as a Jewish settlement, begun in 1909. If breaking ground for Kibbutz Hanita in 1938 by Moshe Dayan and friends was kosher, breaking ground for every Jewish community built in Judea and Samaria post-1967 was also kosher. The League of Nations explicitly allowed for the amputation of eastern Palestine, the Eastern Bank, as was marked on maps, to be a separate Arab entity, which became Jordan. But then, all the rest of western Palestine, west of the river, was to be the site of the Jewish homeland explicitly called for in the mandate. Every Jewish community in Judea and Samaria is as kosher as Kibbutz Hanita, which is still there on the Lebanese border to this day. And that Israelis like the Jerusalem Post journalists publish articles using vocabulary that covers up the Jewish connection to this real estate, calling it West Bank, is an abomination. Then again, it's all perfectly understandable since the post-religious Zionist movement envisioned a non-Jewish Jewish state, a non-religious Jewish state, and how blind and intellectually and spiritually crippled they were to think that there could be such a thing as a Jewish identity without the religion. Actually, I shouldn't be surprised. It's a story of my own family. I'm representative of millions of American Jews of a certain generational cohort, the 2 million who reached America between 1881 and 1921. The number one newspaper that many of them read, not all, with a daily circulation of 200,000 at its peak, it was the largest socialist newspaper in the country, was the Fovitz, the Jewish Daily Forward. That was my grandfather and grandmother's community. He was a labor union organizer. He began life as a yeshiva bucher in Vilna, Lithuania, but like legions of his contemporaries, at a certain point, the tidal wave of enlightenment that had begun in West Europe more than a century before caught up with Eastern Europe, and off went his kippah and his kashrut. And I have some of his books. I have Das Kapital in Yiddish. I have Darwin's Origin of Species in Yiddish. I have Engels and Bakunin, also in Yiddish. My grandfather became a Bundist, that was a social democrat, and also a Yiddishist, a lover of Yiddish. Like Shalom Aleichem, grandfather, spiritually speaking, of Fiddler on the Roof, and the Yiddish writers at the time. They were heretical Jews, but they still loved the language and the Jewish people, and thought that they could sustain a new non-religious Jewish identity as a founding president of the Furriers Union, a labor organizer. He was also, for a time, employed by the Hebrew Actors Union when there were 20 working Yiddish theaters in New York City, doing plays about Jewish life in Yiddish, but also in translation Chekhov and Strindberg and Shakespeare. They, too, wanted a Jewish identity without the religion that they made fun of. Such types would on Yom Kippur chow down at a banquet of ham and cheese sandwiches to exercise their liberation from the opiate of the masses. I once asked my grandmother, a blessed memory, what they thought of the Zionists in the early 20th century, and they said there were only a handful in her city, town, in Poland, and everybody thought they were crazy. But despite the difference of philosophies between these Yiddishists who went to America and the handful of Zionists, they all share this mistaken belief that it was possible to sustain the Jewish people without the Jewish religion. And so there was this week this dispute, mentioned last time, I think, over how to spend $65 million on outreach to Americans of Jewish extraction, which Quest seems to have resulted from, among other things, a recent Pew poll back in 2013, showing 40% of American Jews between the ages of 18 and 29 feeling no attachment to Israel. 40%, that's a death sentence for that connection. That poll also recorded 75% of them thinking Israel is not making a sincere effort toward peace. And Democrats. And I say I'm glad that most of the money is therefore going to Chabad and Olami, which I do not know, but it was reported to be like Chabad as an Orthodox, what the Depost calls ultra-Orthodox organization. The reality is that without the religion, there is no Jewish identity. There is no national identity. Harut Shevi yesterday reported on a new committee of directors general of different ministries who want to legalize violating the Sabbath in Tel Aviv more officially than it already is. They want some 160 stores to be allowed to do business on the Sabbath and holidays. And who was leading the charge in this campaign? Making the argument that the people of Tel Aviv have the democratic right to live as they choose? Why, it's City Councilman Mickey Gitzin, who we heard about last webcast. He who heads that NGO called Israel Chofshit, Free Israel, meaning free of Judaism. He's the guy who wants punitive action taken against those 300 rabbis who wrote a letter supporting Rabbi Levinson and his vocabulary that Gitzin cannot tolerate. In other words, this is just another story of some Israelis going on a crusade to de-Judaize Israel. It's a perennial problem in this people, older than the age of the Maccabees. J-Post yesterday reported on another poll recording that only half of the Israelis polled believe Israel is responsible for Jews outside the country. That poll was commissioned by the Ministry of Diaspora Affairs, and it also found that the majority of respondents were unenthusiastic about investing funds in Jewish identity efforts in the diaspora. Only 9% strongly agreed with the idea. 18% agreed if not enthusiastically. The rest did not. I'm pretty much with the ones who did not, because I suspect that fostering Jewish identity in the diaspora is the last thing that Israelis can do, that is, the non-religious ones. What Jewish identity did the pollsters have in mind? What is this identity without the religion? I knew American Jewry was on the way out, that is, the non-Orthodox ones, about 20 years ago, when there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal on a Hillel house in some Midwestern college whose most popular event at Hillel weekly was not going to Sabbath services, but sitting around a television together and watching the Seinfeld program. Now, that was a wonderful program, one of a long string of television comedy successes dominated by Jews, but there's nothing in it to pass on to the next generation. It's no surprise that Israelis care so little for Jews abroad, because in truth, those abroad have so little in common with them, other than a common gene pool. It's a well-known fact that the million-plus Israelis who left Israel and made their homes in the U.S. do not mix with American Jewry. They don't identify with them, because both groups are not religious, by and large. The way of life that linked all Jewish communities everywhere in the world in the diaspora for thousands of years no longer exists for those American Jews. This city councilman, Mickey Gitzin, is a crusader for a more de-Judaized Israel, and he's a sly one. He says his plan is not to duplicate the weekday in Tel Aviv, but just allow people walking to the beach to buy a bottle of water on the way. This is rubbish. His community drives to the beach on Saturday anyway, and they bring whatever food they want to from home. He just wants another crack in the wall, another hole, with no little Dutch boy to stick his finger in it and plug it up. The war against Jewishness by Jews like him is eternal. If I were a politician, I might offer the Mickey Gitzins of Israel a deal. Many of them would love to go to a normal work week of 5 days and 2-day weekend. Non-religious types say, of course, that they jump into their cars on Shabbos to go shopping and have fun with the kids, because that's the only day they can. What might be worth a test for a couple of years is the following. Israel goes to a week with a Sunday, as in the West, a day for shopping and traveling around and not working, but Shabbos itself would become more observant in Israel than ever before. A real observance by the entire country. No commerce, which means no restaurants, no cafes, no movie theaters, no live theater, no Israeli television. One of the great benefits of the Sabbath is the time that families spend with one another, eat meals together, undistracted by TV and iPhones and computers. A real Shabbos day, unlike any other day in any other country in the world. Now, that's what I would call Jewish identity, and that's why it's wise, I think, for the bulk of the funds allocated for this outreach wind up in the hands of religious Jews. For the old Israel of Chalutzim and pioneers, driving back the desert and making it bloom, that's all ancient history. Israel is like other countries in the West now. One of its major problems is too much traffic. There's gridlock, too many cars on the roads. Israel's also building skyscrapers, apartment skyscrapers, office building skyscrapers. We're talking about buildings, 60, 70 stories tall. There are cranes working all over the country. Likewise, modern Hebrew, the language every day, molts a little bit into a kind of Hebrew English, like Yiddish was a Hebrew-German combo, and Ladino a Hebrew-Spanish melange. Like the language of Caucasian Jews that was, strangely enough, called Jewry. In its first decades, the state, that is, 48 to 68, there was no television here. Entertainment was other people. Israel was very much cut off from the rest of the world. They were behind the times in fashion and music. And Israelis at the time, those who could go abroad, they had little money, went overseas, were recognizable by their dress, by their carriage, the way they carried themselves. Today, Israelis in Tel Aviv and Haifa who speak Hebrew come across as non-Jews, an apparent unconscious imitation of the culture they see daily on the internet. and in the movies and on TV and when traveling abroad. So what is this Jewish identity that some Israelis think they can market overseas? Just what is it that are they going to sell to these alienated Americans of Jewish descent? What are they going to teach them how to handle an M16 when confronted by an Arab with a knife? Happened yesterday in the Shomron. Some soldiers were bent on arresting an Arab up to his no good somehow, taking him into custody, but he pulled a knife and stabbed one of the soldiers, who shoved him back and in a flash aimed his weapon properly, squeezed the trigger, and deprived the barbarian of his brutish life.
Da-da-da.
You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa.
So, if the topic in the previous sections concerned Jewish identity, if it is possible at all without the religion, religion also remains the hard core of the violence here. Islam's inability to let Jews live free of their tyranny. And this is how to understand another story in the news these days. On Tuesday night, and not for the first time, the IDF had to ride to the rescue of 60 Breslev Hasidim who had gone to the tomb of Joseph in Nablus. That word, by the way, is more evidence than ever was of Palestinian people. Nablus is nothing but the mispronunciation of the Greek name Neapolis, New City. Today's Palestinians, in other words, have no Palestinian name for that city. Officially, Jews are allowed to visit the tomb of Joseph, but only once a month, and on holidays and special memorial occasions, I think, and always under armed Israeli guard, IDF guard. Tuesday night's unlicensed adventure led to their bus being stoned by the local barbarians, and they called the army to save them, which the army did, but then, angrily, they arrested many of them for this unauthorized visit to the tomb of Joseph the Righteous, Joseph the son of Mother Rachel. A police spokeswoman said afterwards, quote, "We view this incident very seriously. It's a criminal offense to enter Area A without permission." And I say this is another abomination that Israelis have learned to tolerate precisely because it concerns religious Jews who do not represent the non-religious ruling class. It's a disgrace, alike referring to Judea and Samaria as West Bank, that Israel tolerates these restrictions on our religious life in our one and only country is pathetic. This is why I've imagined a policy for the Temple Mount that denies Jews the right altogether to enter the Temple Mount, and as a result, we get to tear up the Oslo documents and rule as we choose and live wherever we want in Judea and Samaria. The conflict here, the endless violence here, is akin to what the communists in the Soviet Union did to religious people, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists. The official religion, ideology of the Soviet Union was atheism, and it was taught in schools. And to the enlightened communist mind, it was right to suppress manifestations of the opiate of the masses. And so here Islam cannot tolerate free Jews practicing their religion freely, undisturbed, and in peace. No way, say the Mohammedans. But modern Israel, still too hostile to traditional Jewish identity, refuses to fight for its religious freedom and its religious rights. That we enforce a prohibition on Jewish prayer at Joseph's tomb as a criminal offense is mind-boggling. The problem is that Israelis, the ruling class, have no spirit to fight for the Jewish religion any more than they have to or want to in order to preserve the tourist industry. That Israel tolerates these restrictions on Jewish religious observance is a stain of disrespect on oneself. And given the spiritual, psychological physics of this world, I'd venture that Israel would do much better in the area of public opinion by not lying that Israel wants a Palestinian state and wants peace, but Israel fights for its legal and religious rights, which it never has. If Israel is the object of scorn and contempt in some quarters, maybe it's because Israel demeans itself by putting up with the lies of these people and their 24/7 aggression against us and our free exercise of our religion in our ancient homeland. Tzipi Livni and Yossi Beilin say if Israel defines the conflict as religious, not nationalist, there's no hope for peace. And I say you don't go wrong by disagreeing with these two anti-Jew fools. I say just the opposite. Only when Israel rebrands the conflict for what it is, a religious conflict, and focuses on Islam's imperialist need to crush us, to dominate us, will Israel receive the respect it deserves when it starts to respect itself.
צריך צריך כל אדם לומר כל העולם לא נברא אלא בשבילי נמצא כשהעולם נברא בשבילי צריך אני לראות ולעיין בכל עת בתיקון העולם ולמלות חסרון העולם ולהתפלל בעבורם כי צריך כל אדם לומר כל העולם לא נברא אלא בשבילי צריך כל אדם לומר אוי אוי כל העולם לא נברא אלא בשבילי נמצא כשהעולם נברא בשבילי צריך אני לראות ולעיין בכולת בתיקון העולם ולמלות חסרון העולם ולהתפלל בעבורם נמצא כשהעולם נברא בשבילי צריך אני לראות ולעיין בכולת בתיקון העולם ולמלות חסרון העולם להתפלל בעבורם לא נברא אלא בשבילי לא נברא אלא בשבילי כל העולם לא נברא אלא בשבילי כל העולם לא נברא אלא בשבילי
Last item, it seems there's a new book out there written by Wall Street Journal journalist Jay Solomon, and it's called The Iran Wars, which is surely a bland title, unworthy of the real story beneath, which even the author seems to miss. Solomon's revelation is that Obama did not help the opponents of the Iranian regime in the election period in June 2009, when the regime stole the election, because he wanted his nuclear deal with Iran. Another commentator on the book says it deals with Obama's obsessive drive to turn Iran from enemy to friend. And I differ with that big time. Obama may have looked on the surface to be trying to change minds and hearts in Iran, but underneath he had no criticism of this more powerful, most powerful Muslim regime. The photo archives contain pictures of Obama smiling into the face of Erdogan, the latest version of a Turkish sultan, a tyrant, a supporter of Hamas, a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, the same Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Obama was not out to turn Iran into a friend of the U.S., I think, as this author thinks. He was out to support Iran and not be an obstacle in its drive to topple Israel from its post as the strongest military player in the region. This is the reason for his fidelity to getting a deal with Iran. That is no deal. It's all smoke and mirrors. The Iran deal is just Obama catering to the Iranians because they are unique in the region for their ability to build nuclear weapons and destroy Israel, God forbid, which aspiration is deepest in the hearts of all serious Muslims. Obama did not want Iran to have a change of heart. He has been a supporter of Iran. He signs off on sanctions, as he has, only to create the impression of resistance to its A-bomb project. I hope this man spends eons burning in Muslim hell. Okay, that's it for this evening and this week. I'll be back next week, God willing, after the Holy Sabbath. Until then, Laila Tov, Shabbat Shalom, Me'eretz Yehuda.